Fourth lecture in our course on Asian Buddhist women, hosted by the Numata Center for Buddhist Studies at the University of Hamburg in collaboration with the Dhammadram Institute of Liberal Arts in Taiwan. And it is my great pleasure today to welcome Ayako Ito, who is going to speak to us on the topic of a nascent Bhikkhuni Sangha in Northeast Thailand. Ayako Ito did her PhD at the École Pratique des Hautes Études in Paris, France, in the Department of Religious Science in 2013, under the title The Emergence of the Bhikkhuni Sangha in Thailand, Context, Strategies and Challenges. And it is precisely because of this, in my view, outstanding PhD research that she has done, that we invited her here for this course to give us a summary of her experience and her fieldwork in Thailand, in Northern Thailand, which takes us directly from the first three lectures we had on textual sources in Indian history. It takes us today directly into modern day Thailand and into a situation which is very, very interesting and also very controversial, the issue of the revival of Bhikkhuni ordination, which we covered already 2 years ago. And with that, I hand over to Ayako Ito.
Well, thank you, Venerable Bhikkhu Ananayo, for inviting me for this e-learning course. And so I am Ayako Ito. Nice to meet you all. And as explained by Venerable Bhikkhu Ananayo, today in this lecture, I would like to talk about the main findings or essence of my thesis at the end of this lecture. So I hope this is fine with you. And well, since this is my first time to give an online lecture, I hope everything goes smooth as we wish. Okay, so my thesis was mainly about the community of Thai Buddhist monastic women who had gone through what commonly translated in English as lower and higher ordination, called Pavaja and Upasampada in Pali, respectively, in an aim of becoming fully-fledged nuns, called Bhikkhuni in Theravada tradition, where no official Bhikkhuni lineage had been acknowledged. So my thesis does not argue whether the emerging Bhikkhuni Sangha is legitimate or deviant from the canonical point of view. I think we were caught up too much by this discussion on canonical legitimacy, and also to some extent by the discussion of the promotion of gender equality around the movement. And this, in my view, hindered us to pay more attention on what was actually going on and see who were really the actors and participants of the movement and the motives and in practice and so on for a while. So instead, my study takes the existing phenomenon as an object of study, and I try to understand about these women who are seemingly in a subversive path. As some of you might know already, that it is officially banned for Thai women to go through Pavaja and Upasampada in Thailand by the decree issued by the Krom Luen Chanawon Siriwat, the former Supreme Patriarchy of Thailand, Thai Sangha, in 1928, and the decree is still in effect. So I try to understand what it means for them to become Bhikkhuni, the fully-fledged nun, and how the de facto Bhikkhuni Sangha started to take root, and what the grounds for its social acceptance. At the beginning, the movement of reinstallation of Bhikkhuni Sangha in Thailand was generally thought that it represented very small portion of women, and it would not take root in Thai society, since there has been more widely practiced traditional form of female Buddhist renunciation, such as that of white-robed renunciants who observe 8 precepts called Meichi. But between 2008 to 2011, the number of bikini increased from 6 to 30 or 31, and as far as I know, more than 300 women took temporary pavaja or pavaja in Thailand altogether. So, and I'm sure that the number has increased since then. So I believe, however, non-official, the acceptance of female taking both pavaja and pasampara by a certain segment of society deflects the existing dissonance over the identity of contemporary Thai Theravada tradition, and the expansion of such phenomena concerns all stakeholders of Theravada Buddhism. Okay, so my thesis had basically two large parts: historical study on female Buddhist monasticism in the Sans Bikini Sangha called Nirodharam. So Niroda is a cessation and Aram is the resident, let's say. And so it was the headman of the community wanted this place to be where the cessation of suffering takes place, and that's why it's called Nirodharam. Okay, so I will mainly speak of the findings from my field work, but before turning into speaking of what I found from the field, I would just like to stress that historical part, this is historical study into female monasticism in Thailand, was also very important to me, and I dedicated a large part to the historical background of female Buddhist female monasticism in Thailand, as it was a part of my argument that the emergence of Bikini Sangha in Thailand or even in other Theravada countries is a needle point in time and space, as the movement are generally thought or seen as a revolutionary and foreign imposition. It is often discussed as though it was detached from the history and tradition to which these women belong to. But I argue that no matter how significant a leap from the past it is, the phenomenon that we observe today is not detached from the past, but on the contrary, it uses on the past with its contingencies and conditions. And therefore, the development of the current Thai Bikini movement should be assessed, also taking into account the historical existence and diversity of practice and form of renunciation common to female renunciation in Thailand. Okay, so now I would like to turn to my ethnological part, the study and discuss the profile of women and focus of practice and the Nirodharam's relationship with monks of the community when it first started, and which is subject to any change or mutation in the future, and they can be different today already. Oh, and I would like to discuss them by countering some prevailing assumptions about the Bikini movement in Thailand, which presented some truth, but not entire truth, and which was, in my view, obscuring our understanding of the fuller picture of the phenomenon. And these assumptions were as such. Hold on, I wanted to show this picture when I was talking about my research and methods. Sorry about that. There you go. So the assumption about the emergence of Bikini in Thailand that I witnessed. So first, women becoming Bikini are Western-minded, and movement is a Western position. That was the first assumption that prevailed, that I felt. And second, Thai Buddhist monks are against women becoming Bikini in Thailand. So there was this dichotomy between monks and then a woman who wants to become Bikini. And third, the women becoming Bikshuni want to have higher social status than Buddhist community. So those were the three strong prevailing assumptions about women who wanted to become Bikshuni. When I said, but however, after having done my field work, I believe that any of these simplistic evaluations represent the reality. And worse, as I said, they have the risk of preventing us to see the diversity of the vocation and identity and practice of the female and male Thai Buddhist monastics. And I will try to show how so by sharing with you what I found from my field work. Okay, so now let me first introduce my field, the community of Nidotharam. Okay, so that's the location of Nidotharam, where I circled in red, Chomtong. So I conducted my field work on one of the first Bikshuni community in Thailand, or it was certainly the largest at that time, from 2007 to 2008. And the first community was the Wat Samsam Kalyani Convent of Bikshuni Dhammananda, the very first one, and who went through Pabaja and Sri Lanka in 2001 to Sayam Nikaya lineage, and in 2003 she went through Pasampara and became Bikshuni. Now the community of Nidotharam where I conducted my field work was called Samnak Pachipatam Nidotharam, the Nidotharam Meditation Center. Nidotharam is a convent and also a meditation center at that time where lay people can come and practice meditation. And it is found in the district of Chomtong, approximately 58 kilometers southwest of the city of Chiang Mai. And in 2006, the 13 women, the Mechi, from Nidotharam community, led by the head nun, Sister Pabaja, I call Bikshuni Nampeni the title of 2008 because it gets too complicated otherwise. So they went to Sri Lanka and Sri Pabaja under the preceptor of Ben Metsananda of Amarapra Nikaya and chief of the Sangha of Western Province of Sri Lanka. And I lived with the community of Nidotharam straight for the first 3 months in 2007 and then stayed with them for 10 days each month for the following year and a half. So the Nidotharam has been the largest community of ordained Buddhist female monastic in Thailand since 2006 till when I was there, 2008. However, the personality and religious views and practice of these women in community were largely eluded serious scholarly attention for quite some time. Okay, so that's the district of Chomtong, how it looks like. So the most of the inhabitants of Chomtong are farmers cultivating rice and longan. And that's the profile of early ordained members in Nidotharam. Well, I encountered a group towards the end of rain retreat in 2007, and the group was consisted of 10 seminary. Well, three had defrocked since 2006, and one permanent Meiji, and 12 Meiji staying temporarily for the rain retreat. And most of the early ordained members are indeed from northern provinces, as you can see from the table. And four of them spend more than 20 years in robe and as Meiji, and two spend more than 10 years, and one for 8 years, and one for 4 years, and one for 2 years. And in terms of education, almost half, the 50% of the members have university degree, and I think it's considered the level of education is higher than than normal or other communities or other major communities. Okay, so those are the five bhikshuni of Nirodharan, the four in the front and the one in the second row, and two of them in the second row are the Upachaya and the teacher from Sri Lanka. So among the 10 samurai I first encountered in 2007, only five became bhikshuni at the Sampada, which took place in 2008 in Sri Lanka. And there were bhikshuni Nantayani, the head nun, and bhikshuni Panyawari, and bhikshuni Satasiri, and bhikshuni Panapari, and bhikshuni Varachina. So as I said, I will use the title as of 2008 throughout this paper. And this bhikshuni constitutes an important member of the community on a spiritual plane, as only those who have proven themselves and been confirmed by the community as ready on the basis of discipline and knowledge and practice could go through the Sampada ordination. The remaining five samurai from the first batch were Samurai Sunyata, and Samurai Jayani, and Samurai Ratarayani, and Samurai Machima. And Bhikshuni Sraspatran, I'll go back to maybe this. So Bhikshuni Sraspatra did become Bhikshuni in 2008, but not as a member of Nirodharan, as she left the group in the beginning of 2008, and she went on her own with her monk teacher, I believe, and became Bhikshuni separately from the Nirodharan group. Okay, well, now I spoke about many Papaja happened in Thailand and also in Sri Lanka. So I would like to show you this map or picture just to situate us with the different Papaja and Upasampada happened in the course of my research. Well, 2006, I was not there, but that was the first time that the 13 Meichi from Nirodharan went through Papaja in Sri Lanka. And then, February 2008, they organized a Papaja in Chammar, and 12 Meichi became seminary. And in April, there was an Upasampada and Papaja in Sri Lanka. And five seminary from Nirodharan became bhikshuni, and two Meichi from Nirodharan became seminary. And in the same year, in October, there was a Papaja in Chiang Mai organized for seven Meichi in Nirodharan, and they became seminary. So those are those three in 2008 that I could personally assist. Okay, so in terms of Buddhist practice the community adapted in their Buddhist career, well, the prior to the establishment of Nirodhana in 1995, okay, so this is, okay, I just wanted to show you the nuns and monastic cell here. The five of the above 10 early members, including the head nun, practiced in a monastery belonging to forest tradition, whose mode of practice and the life are centered on the practice of meditation and foster ascetic discipline and seclusion rather than on scriptural study and life in cities. Bhikkhuni Nantayani has always practiced 10 precepts and vegetarianism and non-use of shoes since her taking of robes of Meichi. And Bhikshuni Nantayani and Bhikshuni Panyawari and Samurai Jirayani met him met and practiced together in locally known forest monastery called Wat Tham Thong in Chiang Mai, where outside contact and speaking and readings are limited in favor for the practice of meditation. And Samaneri Sunyata and Samaneri Saspatra practice in a hermitage called Samnat Song. The hermitage doesn't have the status of Wat because it doesn't have the ordination hall. Well, anyways, there's a hermitage called Tudong Satang Yusuk Chelun, run by the forest monk in that province. So as for Samaneri Ratayani, she used to also focus on meditation practice in another meditation center run by a locally famous Meiji in the view of improving her health and the rest of three debuted to monastic life in Nirodhana. Okay, so that's the Kuchi and okay, so that's the daily schedule at Nirodhana. So the day at Nirodhana starts at 3:30, and that's when the wake up bell rings, and it's actually earlier than the majority of monks' monasteries, which usually the monks wake up around 5 o'clock. And 4 to 5, we have 1 hour of meditation already in sala together. And we had half an hour Dhamma talk. And then morning chanting followed by that. And then from 6, we have alms round. And those who do not participate in alms round, we do cleaning. And then from 8 to 9, we had one meal. And that was the only, that's the first and the last meal of the day in Nirodhana. And from 9 a.m. to 1:30, we had the time for solitude and personal development, or basically the meditation. Those who can, who has the time for meditation. Sometimes the many nuns, usually they receive visitors and so on. So difficult to actually set aside the time for meditation practice. So that goes on until 4, and from 4 we wash the body and do some personal chores, and then we have again 1 hour and a half of the meditation and sala together, and then we have evening chanting, and we have 1 hour of Dhamma talk. And basically the head nun speaks Dhamma in the morning and at night. And yes, she's really into giving a Dhamma talk to her disciples, and this is really something that everybody, that's when we really learn about the teaching of the Buddha. And this is not about anecdote, but she really gives a serious explanation about the consciousness from Abhidharma and all those things. Okay, and from 8 to 9, from 9 to 10, so we have another solitude time. But this is when actually many nuns sometimes they do have to get together and do some administrative meetings. And especially before the taking of Papaji Alpasampada, that they have many administrative meetings to do. So the late was really, we wake up very early in the morning, but the night was always late. And you know that. Okay. So that's the community of Nirodharan in February 2008. The members founded. Okay, but now I would like to speak about the motivation for women to join in a community. The motivation, or the most cases, motivations of Thai women for leaving the household to become Meiji have been already explored by the Lindbergh folk, or Radcliffe and Takahashi. And the diverse motivations found in aforementioned works regarding Meiji are also found among the nuns in Nirodhara, together with some other things that are less explored by these works. So most of the permanent members of Nirodhara that I encountered during my field work period from 2007 to 2008 joined the community to become Meichi, to pass the So the early ordained members did not join the community to become ordained monastics. But I would like to discuss their motives for joining the community, since they are related to how and why they were brought to the decision of going through Papaja and Upasampada. For the most nuns in Nirodhara, their motivation to become nuns share the same features with those of the Meiji portrayed in the previous studies, with three particularities which characterize the general motivations of the group of disciples in Nirodhara. So the inclination for forest monk style practice, such as vegetarian diet and eating once a day and wearing no shoes, using no money, and meditating seriously, and the charisma of head nun, both for teaching and personalities. And finally, some newcomers join the community in the pursuit of becoming seminary and bhikkhuni from 2006 on. So maybe I should say just one word about the forest monks. Who are the forest monks? When I said about the forest monk style practice, the forest monks are traditionally the forest dwellers, or those who temporarily took up a fixed residence in order to cultivate a spirituality based on meditation. But in reality, so there's this dichotomy, duality or dichotomy of forest monks and city monks practice. City monks attend to focus on scriptural studies, but those practices are not exclusive. And of course, in reality, the forest monks do also study, and the city monks also do practice meditation. But it's a personal inclination. But a bit more than that, the forest monks do have their masters and the lineage of the forest monk communities. Okay, so the one of the characteristic of the motivation or the motives for the women who joined the Hirotana was the appeal of the forest practice and the meditation skills and austere asceticism of Bhikkhuni Nantayani demonstrated by the practice of eating only one vegetarian meal a day and wearing no shoes, and she excelled in meditation, that motivated many members to join the community. And this type of practice can be identified as the part of the forest traditions. As it puts emphasis on meditation and rigorous asceticism, first from the forest tradition, in that by the time Nirodhara was founded, I think it was convinced of the importance of understanding correctly the Buddha. Thus, the nuns in community do need to spend some time, or quite a lot of time, learning Pali Buddhist canon, Tripitaka, from her teachers with her sermons. That's one of the reasons why she was giving Dharma talk of a long time, twice a day, every day. But by enlarged from the interviews with the nuns expressed the inclination for the first type practice as their Buddhist vocation. And here I should probably say something about education and studying in Nirodhara. Bhikkhuni Nantayani holds an ambivalent view of higher education of her disciples, and she maintains that leading a monastic life according to the Buddha's teaching is the best education that one can obtain. At the same time, she thinks that those with a higher education tend to understand her teaching better And she thinks that those with a higher education, the educational background, she also emphasized the educational background of disciples who have attained a degree when introducing them to monks or their followers. So choosing a monastic life after they have accomplished higher level of education, so it eloquently conveyed the idea of how much more the noble and rewarding life of the Buddhist monastery can be compared to a lay life with fame and wealth. So this impressed many among the Thai people and inspired respect. So regarding the monastic educational level, Bhikshu Thanh did not provide any formal education or prepare her disciple for government Buddhist exams such as Dhamma Suksa or Upadhi exam on Abhidhamma until 2008. But this may be a very different future of the community compared to other samnas that affiliated with Thai Meichi Institutes, which focuses on education and encourages Meichi residents to hold formal educational degree, both Buddhist and secular. However, this does not mean that the Nidotaran nuns are not engaged in Paiyatipa Buddhist studying. The Bhikshu Nantani tires through gives the daily lessons and Dhamma talks and heavily drawn from the analysis of mental phenomena and Abhidhamma using numerous Pali terms. But she teaches at least, yes, and she teaches at least 2 hours a day. And her disciples are also assigned afternoon after chanting and meditation sessions as the individual homework by Bhikshu Nantani and really to learn those terms. But the situation of living the community has changed over time. And when I was there, she did not prepare her disciples for the exam. But the educational policy in New York changed in 2009, and after I finished my field research, Bhikkhu Nantani decided to give proper Pali lessons, inviting monks in Pali to teach her disciples and encourage them to take those national Dhamma and Pali exams. So I heard, and it's partly because they became Samanari and Bhikkhu and many public followers are more trying to check if they really know what they should know as a proper monastic. So apparently the educational policy changed in Nidotaran now. Okay, so this is the picture of the Bhikshu Nantani, and I come with the third characteristic of the women and how why did women join in Nidotaran community is the charisma of the head nun, the Bhikshu Nantani. So the many accounts by the early members of the community relate the decision of taking robes to the personal attributes of Bhikshu Nantani and her personality and her strict practice and her ability to clearly explain complicated Buddhist teachings. So Samani Uttarayani stated most clearly that, quote, if I had not met Pra Achan, Pra is monolithic term and Achan is teacher, and I would not have become Meichi. The quote finished. The Bhikshuni Panyawari and Bhikshuni Sapasiri and Bhikshuni Varachana and Bhikshuni Panapari also all tie their Meichi ordination to their faith and Bhikshuni Nantayani. So this type of strong master and disciple relationship is not rare in Thai Buddhist tradition among monks, and it also explains why her disciple would follow her decisions when Bhikkhuni Nampayani thinks it is the right thing to become Bhikkhuni, they would also think it is the right thing to do. Watandia has already explored the source of this charismatic leadership in his through meditation. And he saw the charisma of Buddhist saints, many of whom were first monks, as something earned, but volatile and unstable compared to that of the more institutionalized charisma, for example, of Christian saints. However, Tambia stated that the routinization of charisma of first monks is possible, and to a certain extent, and if the disciple of the masters can coordinate themselves systematically, their network can lead to an alternative grid of power and modern mobilization to established system such as Sangha. So Samanani Walayani once told me that when she saw Bhikkhuni Nantayani, who seemed to be intelligent and confident and explaining Dhamma so clearly to the large audience during the Buddhist camps, she wanted to become like her. And she believed that the Bhikkhuni Nandayani's practice and faith in Buddhism made her intelligent and confident. And Samanayi Tilayani was also impressed by the young Bhikkhuni Nandayani then Amici, as she was intelligent and adhering to a very strict practice. So many others also expressed that they were impressed with her first monk-like practice and her ability to speak and teach so well. So the Bhikkhuni Nandayani seems to be admired for her spiritual achievements through years of practice, morality and meditation, just like first monks. But again, she's not a saint, meaning that her salvational status as arahant is not yet completed nor acknowledged as such by the public. However, she certainly does exude a charisma based on her spiritual achievements through years of practice, a morality and meditation just like first monks. So the austere first monk style tradition that Bhikkhuni Nandayani has practiced since her early days in Lhasa Tam has brought her veneration and elevated her from Meichi to the Meichi of forest tradition, and the rigorous renouncement of worldly attachments observed by forest monks is admired by lay followers as seen in the work of Tambia and Tyler, and the source of charisma, moreover, seems gendered. So Bhikkhuni Nandayani has been admired all the more for being a woman, especially a young Meichi then, when she was at Wat Tham Thom, who practiced in the first tradition and who can teach Dharma so well, precisely because the society previously had the image of Meichi as spiritually inferior and loose in practice, and austerity of the practice of Bhikkhuni Nandayani and her ability to deliver clear Dharma sermons in public stands out as a unique case. And the last the motives are quite particular for the Nirodharan, the motivation for women to join the Nirodharan community was the opportunity for going through Papajana Pasampara. So during my field work, I was able to identify six nuns who joined Nirodharan primarily because of the aspiration to undergo Papajana and Pasampara ordination. In general, these nuns already had years of experience at Meichi and other monasteries before coming to Nirodharan, and they learned about the possibility of undergoing ordination in Nirodharan via the network of their old monasteries. So most nuns concerned here are from northeast region, Isan of Thailand, with exception of two who are from Bangkok, and they come from a modest family background, except those of the one Mongolian whose family was running a company. And they were all quite young, average of 47 years old, and the four came from monasteries. Affiliated with the forest traditions. So another commonality of note is that most of them did not previously seek the opportunity to undergo Pavaja and Pasampada ordination, but their decision was rather circumstantial and in large part due to the encouragement and support of their monk teachers. And the case of two samurai from Wappa, Panlang, who were convinced by the abbot monk to go through Pavajan ordination was quite exemplary. And Wappa Panlang is actually affiliated to a group of forest monks who used to give a 10 precept to Meiji. And abbots of the Wappa Lampan also believe that the going through Pavaja and Upasampada would help women to practice better, and that's why he convinced, actually, or he gave advice to his female disciple to go through Pavaja and Upasampada, and they came to Nirvana. So when we see the profile of these women and the motivation for joining the group, the community of Nirodhara, they cannot be best described as Western-minded or those are the reason why that they seek or they became a vixen. Or some may be well-educated, but that could be true. But the assumption that the women become vixen or Western-minded was not entirely correct. And the second assumption about monks against women, and I think you probably started to see already from the people coming to Nirodhara for ordinations and who support women in Nirodhara to go through Pavajana Pasampada, that this may not be also entirely true. And for the taking of Pavaja and Upasampada, women in Nirodhara, the support and approval of local monk, especially of the high venerated monk, such as Lampo Thon, was indispensable. So that's the photo of Lampo Thon in Wat Chom Thon. So Lampo Thon, Lampo means venerable father, is an advisor to the ecclesiastic chief of the Chiang Mai region, and he is a much venerated monk whose reputation goes well beyond the northern region and is annually invited by the king to participate in his birthday ceremony in Bangkok, or at least when I was there, that was the case. And the master and disciple relationship between Dixi Nanfeni and Lampo Thon goes back to when Dixi Nanfeni was practicing meditation up until 17 hours a day in forest monastery, Wat Tam Thong, where Lampo Thon also taught meditation from time to time. So before taking our Pavaja in Sri Lanka, Dixi Nanfeni, then Meiji went to speak with Lampo Thon in order to ask for advice on the matter, and she was given permission and encouragement for going forth through Pavaja by him, and subsequently she also received favorable opinion from other monks in the local area. Lampo Thon also celebrated Pavaja and gave blessings for women in Nirodhara when Nirodhara nuns organized Pavaja in Chiang Mai in 2008, helped by Sri Lankan bhikkhu and bhikkhuni who came to Thailand. A Another local monk who played an important role in development of the community of ordained women in Irotaran is Kurbae. So Kurbae is the ecclesiastic chief of the district of Champa and respected monk. And Kurba is the title given to a Northern Thai monk. And this is the title, the title is popularly and unofficially assigned by merit. But it used to be a proper title in Buddhism practice in the region, but not the case today. And this Kurba is some years younger than Bhikshu Nandini, and it is unclear since when they know each other, but the Kurba knows Bhikshu Nandini since when she was Meichi, and he respects Bhikshu Nandini by calling her Me, the mother. And Kurba participated in the Pabajan ceremony in 2008, the February one, organized by Nirotaran in Thailand, and he was introduced to the audience as a long-time supporter of the community. And he gave speech to the audience that he openly supports the reinstallation of Bhikshuni Sangha if they practice well. And we should also not forget that the abbot of a very well-known monastery in Chiang Mai, whose name I will not openly discuss today, but who agreed to become the preceptor for the women at the second Pabajan ceremony in 2008, in October, in Chiang Mai. And at that time, he was the next in line of ecclesiastic chief of province of Chiang Mai, and being a preceptor of these women could jeopardize his career, but with the encouragement of the Kurba also, that he nonetheless agreed and performed Pabaja for these women in monastery. And here I should mention that some monks in Chiang Mai consider themselves belonging to Northern Buddhist tradition that is distinct and distant from that of centralized Buddhist Sangha for its history and geographical distance from Bangkok. And it can partly explain why some Lhana monks can take bold actions. And the northern part of Thailand where Chiang Mai was found, it used to be called Lhana, and it literally means a million rice fields, and it is the name of the kingdom which emerged in the 13th century and prospered around 15th century, centering Chiang Mai city, and extended its territory from Mekong River to its east and the Salween River on the west, and from the top of the Sukhothai kingdom at its south up to Chiang Mai city in the north. So from the end of the 19th century, the King Chulalongkorn Siam started to implement a series of reform programs of the national administration system and centralized all the variants of Theravada Buddhists into a single national Thai Sangha. And Thai government officials replaced the local nobilities in Lhana, and Buddhist monks in the north were incorporated into the central Sangha hierarchy system, and the national Buddhist educational system. But as you can imagine, this was not done without contestation between Lhana monks and monks from Bangkok. And there are many legends of how locally venerated Kurba rebelled against the centralization, and these legends are still very much part of the memory of the monks in Lhana. And one of the high-ranking monks in Chiang Mai that I interviewed openly expressed in one of my at that time, 2008, that the monks in other regions may be afraid of the central Thai Sangha, but Lhana monks are not. And Bhikshu Nidhamananda, whose monastery is found near Bangkok, also said to me once that the situation in Bhikshu in North is somewhat different from in the central, and the monks are more enthusiastic about emerging Bhikkhuni Sangha there compared to the monks in Bangkok. Having said it, the same cooperative relationship can be observed in Bhikkhuni Dhammananda's community and Wat Sankama Kariyani. And Venerable Dhammananda taking our Prabhuja was in 2001, and she founded her Sangha. So her community is the oldest, and it is found near Bangkok area, Nakhon Pathom. And in 2002, a year after the Prabhuja of Bhikkhuni Dhammananda, then Dhammarakkhita, a highly educated and experienced Meichi, received Prabhuja with the support of Penmonk, Lompo, Kosin, Paripuno, and Bhikkhuni Dhammananda. And Lompo Kosin belonged to progressive Buddhist NGO called Sekiyatam. And Sekiyatam is a group which consists of both laypersons and monks who aim to apply Buddhist principles to the development of the individual as well as Thai society. As well as, And Sekiyatam was officially established in 1991, although it was originally created by well-known lay Buddhists called and Buddhist reformer Silat Sivaraksa in 1989. And according to some study, it is an offshoot of Silat's larger group and Thai Inter-Religion Commissions for Development, which was also established in 1989. So other than these cases cited above, there are many other monks, among so-called forest monks and socially engaged monks, who encouraged and supported women to take up 10% regardless of the degree, or encourage them to go through Prabhuja and Upasampada as a result. So, and some might support particular women whom they judge worthy of a proper monastic environment to take on Upasampada. And while others might support the Bhikkhuni Sangha in general, as they judge that it is part of their socially engaged or progressive reform Buddhist ideal. And for many monks and nuns, and the establishment of a Bhikkhuni Sangha is not just about helping a small sect of women desiring to become fully fledged nuns, but also about changing the larger picture of what contemporary Theravada Buddhism should be, that it can continue to be relevant to the society around it. And the last point about the supporting role of monks is that, as also discussed in the Venerable Bhikkhu Analayo's paper, the going forth of Mahāpadipati Gautami in T60. In order for Bhikkhuni to be able to properly remain as a Bhikkhuni, there are rituals which requires participation of Bhikkhu, and such as Savarana, one of the Sangakama, which is organized after the rain retreat to confess any wrongdoings that was thought, seen, and heard, and members of Sangha, or it required 5 members for Pavarana, should hold Pavarana on the first full moon day right after the rain retreat in Bhikkhuni, organized Pavarana separately from Bhikkhu, but after their own session they should hold another ceremony of Pavarana in the presence of Bhikkhu. So that's what they did, and the picture shows this moment. They hold the Pavarana ceremony in Uposatha Hall. The nuns says this place is forbidden for women, but in what Chamtong, those group of women, ordained women, the Bhikkhuni, could go in and practice Pagorana in presence of the bhikkhu. So, yeah, so not just Pavajana or Upasampada, but in order for those newly became bhikkhuni to remain bhikkhuni, they need cooperation of bhikkhu, and they do have cooperation until now, at least. But that's the, actually the picture inside. There are actually two more bhikkhu that cannot be seen. I don't know if you can see their faces, but they're all smiling, and they seem to be quite happy to have those women in this hall. So, the third assumption that women become embedded in Buddhist community. For this, well, I would like to explain what I can about this assumption, since I investigated that what it means to be bhikkhuni for women who are actually going through Pavajana Pasampada. And the question of what it means to be bhikkhuni is highly subjective, and it might very well depend on how advanced the one's practice also. But as long as discourses put forward by bhikkhuni Nandayani and the women in Nirodharan, it is safe to say that there are at least other motives that are more important to consider do exist for women to aspire to become bhikkhuni. For bhikkhuni Nandayani, being a bhikkhuni represents a way of practice, a way of life. And I will explain now what does this mean. Well, first of all, I would like to introduce to you how bhikkhuni is defined. The bhikkhuni vivanga section, bhikkhuni vivanga section in Vinaya defines bhikkhuni as she is a nun because she is a beggar for alms. She's a nun because she's a mist walking for alms. And she's a nun because she's one who wears the patchwork robes. And she's a nun by the designation of others. A nun because of her acknowledgement. A nun to whom it was said, come nun. A nun is one ordained by the three goings to refugees. A nun is an adept. And a nun is ordained by both complete orders by means of a formal act at which the motion is put and followed by the three proclamations. It is irreversible and fit to stand. In this way, is this nun one who is ordained by both complete orders by means of a formal act at which the motion was put and followed by three proclamations. Irreversible and fit to stand, and this is how nun is to be understood in this case. So now, the bhikkhuni Nandayani is fully aware of this definition and says that little bhikkhuni is essentially the one who asks. And she also thinks that the bhikkhuni is one who sees danger in the circle of birth and death. By adapting the notion of bhikkhu from Vishuddhi Magga by Buddhaghosa, which defines bhikkhu as he sees fear. So the bhikkhuni Nandayani said once that the meaning of bhikkhuni inspired her deeply, as a bhikkhuni has to ask and depend on teaching of the Buddha, Arya Sangha, and lay community, and thus this understanding of the word encouraged her to be patient, calm, and practice diligently. She also said in one of my interviews this, quote, at this stage, the five bhikkhuni at the Nirodhara Meditation Center are simply women who see danger in the circle of birth and death, who try to practice according to the Dharma in the Vinaya, that was laid down by the Lord Buddha. that is, women who try to maintain Chula Sila, Majjhima Sila, and Maha Sila, who try to exercise and restraint with regard to the Bhikshuni Patimokkha and the Eight Garudama, who try to progress down the Noble Eightfold Path in order to realize the total cessation of suffering. We are only that, nothing more. So therefore, the Bhikshuni, for Bhikshuni Nampayani, to be a Bhikshuni is foremost, for or essentially, to engage in the life and practice assigned for Bhikshuni by the Buddha. And for Bhikshuni Nampayani, going through Upasampara and wearing patchwork robes and going for alms rounds, adhering to Patimokkha and respecting Garudama and all represents a great value. And she certainly thinks that behind all these rules and regulations set by the Buddha for ordained monastic and everything that comes with the ordination is in order to spiritual development of monastic and harmonious well-being of Sangha. Well, let me explain further why she thinks rituals and wearing monastic robes and going on alms rounds important when these can be regarded as minor compared to scripture study or meditational practice. For some meiji or some monks. For example, monastic robe, the five requisites, the first requisite for Buddhist monastics needed to be of a particular color, size, design, and maybe more particular, and dyed in wood. Monastic robe is the symbol of monasticism that is taken only for and thus narrated surrounding the Bhikshuni Sangha. However, we should recall that the mother of Bhikshuni Dhammananda was charged with impersonating a monk wearing a light yellow robe some 3 decades ago. In the words of Ajahn Chah, the famous first monk in Thailand, it is even the banner of the noble ones, the Buddha and the Arahants. Therefore, the importance of the symbol or banner of the purity and Dharma that the monastic robe expresses for its wearer and its perceived to express by society is indeed real and significant. And the symbolism of the monastic robes was indeed intended by the Buddha, as he established regulations and regarding monastic robes precisely for the reason of preserving their distinctiveness. When lay people saw the first bhikkhu wearing ivory robe, untorn cloth, just like those of lay people, they were annoyed and said so. In response to this criticism, the Buddha decided that a bhikkhu's robe be made of torn pieces and sewn together to form a complex pattern, as things which his enemies cannot covet. So the Buddha also told monks not to wear a garment of grass, bark, hair, or not to clad in the skin of a wild animal, feathers of an owl, an antelope skin that are symbol of the Titians meaning adherence of the other things. So therefore, the Buddha intended that the monastic robe serve as a means to differentiate members of Sangha from lay people and adherents of other sects, an example of the importance of form conceived by the Buddha. And Nicola Derrida reports that the Bhikshuni Nampayani is said to have argued that if the monastic wore jeans, one respects or offer alms to them, who would not respect or offer alms to them, and Bhikkhu Nandini praised the insight of the Buddha. As from her report, I quote, "And I disagree that the clothing and attire are not important. If they are not important, then why did the Buddha have to wear the inner garment and the robe? Why didn't the Buddha wear the robe of a king and live as he did before? Why did he give instructions to the Venerable Ananda to design a robe like a rice field, which border ridge and paddies? It is an excellent design full of wisdom." What finish? The comments of Bhikkhuni Nandayani made in regard to robes also demonstrate that she is considering monastic life in its totality and acknowledge that the renunciants have to live with others in society, and therefore she sees monastic robe as serving an important function vis-à-vis society, just as the Buddha intended to. And apart from the social function of the monastic robes, Bhikkhuni Nandayani also believes that wearing a monastic robe helps one practice. She believes that wearing the monastic robe makes you aware of your monastic status in practice, and thereby helping you be more attentive and thus improving your practice. From Samaneri and Bhikkhuni, the robes also make them aware of the practice and precepts, but the important difference is that the Siddha are higher and subtler compared to those of Meiji. Wearing robes would facilitate Samaneri in being attentive and aware of the fact that they should observe 10 precepts and are the official representatives of Dharma toward society. And society would also be watchful of their conduct based on observance of 10 precepts required of Samaneri. And Bhikkhuni Nandayani therefore seems to see at least these two benefits in wearing monastic robes. And Bhikkhuni Nandayani also perceives asking for alms to be also very important and integral part of practice that one can legitimately perform as Samaneri or Bhikkhuni practice. And Bhikkhuni Nandayani once said, quote, "We have to depend on others to give, and we have to ask for alms. And it is indeed very good. It makes you feel humble and makes you reduce dosa and reduce defilement, kilesa, and we feel the responsibility to be good for them, and it is the duty of monastic." Quote finish. So as already stated, going on alms rounds daily reminds the dependence between the monastic and the lay, and this realization makes the monastic feel humble and responsible for being giver of meal offer food. And many Sekhiya rules listed in the Pachimokkha are concerned with how to receive alms from the lay people, and they must receive alms attentively, contemplating the alms bowl, and include the right proportion of curry, and only fill the bowl up to the rim. And it is, in part, these rounds are on display in the most accentuated manner, and therefore need to act flawlessly. The bodily behavior is again an outward sign of their correct mental state of detachment towards what is given and how properly they consider food and one of the requisites. So therefore this is also when they can actually practice virtue concerning requisites and develop their minds to not fall into craving or attachment towards the food and avoid ill will or anger towards the lay community. and cultivate patience. And there's a narrative from a temple Samaneri and Nirodharan who went on alms rounds and who have realized what the lay life really entails by seeing it from the other side, the side of the receiver. And the narrative is revealing that the going on alms round has an important psychological effect as a practice on alms goer. So however Moichis in Thailand are not systematically entitled to go on an alms round for their generally A precept holders. And as already explained, as a visitors belonging to the living and not a proper field of merit by many. And as well, the members did not go on alms round prior to their taking up novitiate, becoming seminary, even though they were meichi and had insights. So according to Bhikkhuni Nantayani, who says, quote, meichi who keep a precept are allowed to have money and can even perform activities to sustain daily life. So I don't know how they do it to justify receiving money from the lay community or food from the community. But I won't complain about those who give and those who receive. Quote finish. So this seems to be what Samaneri Warayani means when she says she feels that she really began abided by the Vinaya laid out by the Buddha when she became Samaneri. She can practice all that a Samaneri is entitled to do according to Vinaya, and she feels more straight and correct. So without having the status of Samaneri and Bhikshu, wearing monastic robes and going on alms rounds, it would be extremely difficult and socially awkward for one to follow the 10 precepts of Samaneri and 311 precepts for Bhikshuni. For the nuns and Nirodhana, therefore, the ordination seems to me robes observing Gaudama and having a Pavachini, their preceptor, and holding Pavajanipasampara, and going on alms round, they had 11 precepts, and holding Pachimokkha and etc. So in short, it means being able to execute all the rituals and practice beginning by the Buddha. And at the same time, trying to confirm whether what they practice and what they represent to the outside world, which they believe provides practicing women more power to demonstrate Dharma for society. This is a painting of the Meiji Bhikkhuni Nantayani on the wall of a local monastery. And actually, other paintings on the wall are all the monks, the very famous monks in Thailand. So this really means that when she was a Meiji, she was already respected by, and also by the monks and in the vicinity. But I should say that she also donated some money for the construction of the sala, which is one of the reasons why she made it up, and her painting made it to this wall. But this is really significant because all the other paintings on the wall are all famous monks. Okay, well, I do believe that the Bhikkhuni Nantayani was not keen on obtaining higher social status by becoming bhikkhuni. And I doubt that being a bhikkhuni alone can bestow someone high social status and entire society. And the narrative of her disciples showed that the charisma and respect that she commands from society and fellow female practitioners were already in place before her taking Upavaja and Upasampada. And therefore, it was not the famous status which comes with becoming bhikkhuni that founded the charismatic leadership of Bhikkhuni Nanfen. So, shows that there's a portrait of Bhikkhuni Nanfen meditating in a cave when she was Meiji. Well, therefore, the other than years of respectful and cooperative relationship between Bhikkhuni Nanfen and monks in the region, it is precisely for the focus on good practice and lack of rights-oriented discourse on having an equal status or higher status in the meaning of social support. And now I think I have challenged the old assumption stated at the beginning about the women becoming bhikkhuni or about the monks' attitudes towards them. And I hope that I could help understand more about the reality of these women of the immersion sangha in Thailand. Well, approaching this phenomenon of the, approaching this phenomenon of the emergence of bhikkhuni communities through women's right discourse or through in-depth humanistic discussion of Padikang and justifying women's proper place in Theravada tradition would provide us with little benefits in understanding the whys and hows of women becoming samanyuri or bhikkhuni and the movements that are beginning to take root in Thailand. As we saw, the majority of women in Thailand who are becoming bhikkhuni and samanyuri have little or no notion at all of Western feminist discourses or little connection with the international movements and do not hold the aim to obtain rights equal to men. In most cases, as with their brothers, they do not systematically engage in any humanistic discussions based on solid scholarly study of Pali canon or of texts of other rich traditions to justify their pursuit for fully fledged nunhood or acquired status. My research aimed to show that if today we see an increase in the number of women taking Upavaja and Upasampada, the phenomenon should not be understood as a shrimp of Western concepts of equality in Thai culture, or only because women's place and rights have increasingly been recognized in Thai society in the past 30 years. Some might have erroneously perceived the bhikkhuni movement as only a women's issue and dismissed the importance of the impact it had on Thai Buddhism. However, I cannot stress enough the point that this phenomenon is not only about a small sector of women in Theravada Buddhism, but that it is indeed an expression of or a part of what Peter Jackson calls a continual process of reappraisal and restructuring of Thai Buddhism, a process which has become dynamic over the past 50 years with the rise of the urban middle class and a time when we observe a significant decline in the number of monks. accompanied by the fragmentation of Pari Theravada Buddhism due to the withering authority of the central Thai Sangha, and manifested concerns among monks regarding the ability to address the female devotees who generally outnumber men in attending Buddhist ceremonies and meditation practice. So there has been a number of monks behind the scenes supported these women to undertake full-fledged nunhood, and the monk proponents of the movement are more prone to a progressive interpretation of Tripitaka for their attempts to accommodate the expectation of the immediate of contemporary society. And however, no matter how much the concerns of the proponents are real and grounded on a local as well as the international level, this attitude can only be acted out by divorcing themselves from the tradition of rigorously adhering to the scriptures, the principle on which the Theravada tradition has been based since the first rehearsal. But this attitude, adapted by numerous Theravada monks, certainly accompany the current Bhikshuni movement in Thailand. And this phenomenon thus mirrors the heart of the debate on the identity of today and tomorrow's entire Theravada Buddhism and its ongoing dialogue and negotiation over ways in which it strives to stay relevant to a contemporary and ever globalizing society. And to the very end, to all of you, I would like to say that if you're interested in the subject, please do read my thesis. And it is not to promote my thesis or say that it's great. No, but since I stopped doing research on the subject, but I know there's still so much to study. And one needs to follow up the development or evolution of the communities. So as they had not been engaged ethnographical study on the community of versions emerging Bhikshuni Sangha in Thailand at that time of my field work, my work contains an ample ethnographical data and description of the community and biography of Bhikshuni, or in this case, I would also like to invite you to read the master thesis of the Nikola Derrida, because it has also a lot of, and lots of insight and ethnographical data. And yeah, and then I also paid attention to the historical aspect of the female monasticism in Thai Theravada context, and referred to some textual sources when I just read them. So I hope that the study, the research that I did, I will be able to serve as a guide or at least as a tool for future researchers who might further investigate in the development of the communities of the ordained Buddhist women in Thailand. Thank you. And now, if you if there are any questions, I guess now it's time for me to take questions and answer. Oh. Thank you. Okay, so I have this question of Venerable Samaneri Niyamika, saying that if the aspirants for the Bhikshuni ordination at Nimathan are still mostly from those with years of major training, or are they now coming more directly from lay life? How is this impacting the environment or focus of training at Nimathan? Okay, to be very honest, as I said, I have not followed this up these days, so I cannot really tell you what's happening right now. But until the very end of my research, well, 2008, but also I was getting some information until 2011-ish, that I still had the impression that the people who were coming to be ordained in the Inotaran community were from Meiji backgrounds, and still not that many coming directly from lay and to be in for the purpose of becoming Bikkusumi and the community. That being said, for the rain retreat, as you saw in the last picture, this is Habaja ceremony during the rain retreat, and all those lay women from the local as well as maybe coming from Bangkok, they must know that they can be ordained as seminary. So now there are many actually, I suppose, come, especially for the rain retreat, to be ordained as a seminary rather than Meiji, and how that impacts the training of Nidotaram. As I said, the latest change was that before they were not, the head now was not preparing their disciples for the government exams or in or Pali or Dhamma Suksa, but now they do. They have to really study Pali, and they have to pass exams. So that's the latest change that I can tell you. Okay. A question from Venerable Bikkusumi Dhammadina. Okay, if the northern Thai tradition is unique independence and even at the times of the central Thai tradition, is it possible that emphasis on non-westernization reflects the typical Thai construct of having resisted one in God? I'm not so sure if I understood the question. Let me get back to this. I'm sorry. Later on, there's another question from Carla. Okay. Okay, I'm not cool. So when I have this kind of question, should I read this and get back to you? There's a link.
It's nice if you can read out.
Sorry, I could not. You're saying something, Venerable.
It is helpful if you can read out the question and then say what you have in reply.
Okay.
And if this is question difficult, we can leave it for later in the program.
Okay. Okay, there's also the question from Venerable Bikkusumi Takaloka. Hello. Okay, so she says it may be the assumption Bikkusumi are Western-minded comes in part from most of the first Bikkusumi appearing in Thailand and contemporary times being American. Being Bikkusumi is really herself and from USA and UK and Tibetan Buddhism. However, I can attest to my personal experience being in Thailand from 2002 to 2003, when most people had never seen a Bikkusumi before, was that many Thai women and Meitji responded immediately from their own end with interest to ordain as bhikkhuni if possible for them in order to advance the practice in accordance with traditional Thai cultural views. And bhikkhu teachers also responded in this way, recommending their exemplary female students to ordain. And this response to meeting a bhikkhuni is very different, almost polar opposite to that experience and published by foreign researchers when asking Thai women and nuns their interest in bhikkhuni ordination. Yes, I do agree with a bhikkhuni, a venerable bhikkhuni Tathagata, and I think there was this over attention to maybe yes, the taking of becoming bhikkhuni of maybe American nuns and also a bhikkhuni Dhammananda who is Thai but who is exceptionally an international figure and who is very by excellence is an elite, and there was a too much focus on the bhikkhuni Dhammananda, and also because she's a prolific writer, she also sends out information, and many foreign scholars and Western scholars could get the information easily, so that there was maybe too much focus on that, and that sort of helped to form this kind of assumption, and which is not completely wrong, there's some truth in it, but that sort of prevented us to see what's really happening in Thailand and what Thai monks really thinking and what are the supporters, Thai supporters who helped those women to take samanery and bhikkhuni ordination, the pavada and the pasampada ordination. Okay, and there is a question from Venerable Samaneri and Yani. Oh, yes, sorry. Yes, the second question. Well, okay, were all most of the Nirodharan bhikkhuni who came from years of Meiji well practiced the meditation? Oh, it seems the daily schedule includes but does not emphasize meditation. Okay. I think the many who came from Forest Monastery did come and join a Nirodharan community with a very strong background on meditation. And so the same thing for the bhikkhuni and Nantayani. I mean, she practiced really prolonged years of meditation when she was in Wat Thampong. But then when she founded the Nirodharan meditation center, they practiced meditation and she was good in guiding and teaching, instructing meditation to her disciples, but she also wanted them to study, not study for the exams, but to listen to her sermons and understand the teaching of Buddha correctly. So since the first groups were already a strong meditation practitioner, that in her daily schedule she more or less emphasized and the Tripitaka study, like sermons. That's why she was given like 2 hours of teaching every day, and two hours per day is quite heavy for her to teach and learn. But she was doing that every day, so maybe that's one of the reasons why even in a daily schedule it doesn't emphasize too much meditation. But let's say for the full moon day, there were nuns who stay up all night meditating because for them meditation is something that they adore and they're really good at practicing. But in Nirodhana, when he was founded, when the head nun wanted her disciple to have a correct view, have a correct understanding of the teaching of the Buddha. So stressed maybe more on learning from Tripitaka on that part. Before the Carla, yes, so I have to read this article that you said. Okay, well, so thank you for the great information and study, and given recent events in Thailand and this article, it seems that situation for bhikkhuni in Thailand is becoming more tenuous over time and not more comfortable. Did you notice this? Do you think it would be a problem for bhikkhuni in the future, and will it affect North and Central equality? Okay, so for this, let me just click on this article. I guess I haven't read it. Right. Hello, okay, well, sorry, I did something wrong. For the sorry, yes. No, I looked on the article of what Kara sent. I'm not so sure if it would have immediate impact on Vixen's status, because in a sense, the core of the problem still remains the same, and I think it really depends on how Bixini will behave in the future or in the present time, and if they can really have a cooperative relationship with monks and be something that's the beneficial for the society or not. And I think if they can do this, I think the Pai society would find a way to accommodate the Vixini Sangha in many ways. So it is threatening this new charter that they can't take out the freedom of the religions. But well, let's see, and if they do actually do this, it has a ramification for a much larger ramification than Vixini Sangha, emergence of Vixini Sangha. So yes, I'm not so sure if I can say something definitive, and I don't think it would have the immediate effects, the negative effects on Vixini activity, Vixini Sangha in Thailand. No. Okay. And okay, so the one last question. Yes, okay. Sorry, my reply is not entirely satisfactory. For the question from Venerable Vixini Dhammajina, please maybe I'll have to get back to you on this. That you said even if the Northern Thailand tradition is quite independent and even at the times opposite to the Central Siam Thai tradition, is it possible that the emphasis on non-Westernization reflects a typical Thai construct of having resisted foreign conquest and influence, which is of course historically not the case given the influence of Western culture, for example in the formative years of King Mong Kut. Yes, maybe I'll get back to you on this to answer. Since I'm not so sure if I understood very well your question. Okay, well, thank you very much. And I think that's all for the question that has been given. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Nicola. Okay. Okay, thank you very much, Venerable Vikanarayan, really for inviting me for this e-learning course, and I was happy to share the findings from my research. I would love to share more, but I could really organize my arguments in such a short time for this. So yes, thank you very much for listening.
recording is off now.